Good afternoon. Welcome. Welcome to the Athenaeum. It's a pleasure to see so many of our members, guests, and others here. This is a significant occasion. All of us who believe that libraries play a central role in the history of this country, and indeed in the world's history, as repositories of our memories, our heritages, our debates, need to pay a special tribute to Benjamin Franklin. This is before we pay tribute to our speaker. To Benjamin Franklin, who, as most of you know, in 1731 founded the Library Company. The Library Company, which nearly 300 years later, in about 10 years, the Library Company will have committee upon committee organizing the 300th anniversary. So that they may have them already, I don't know. It's a wonderful institution with an extraordinarily important history whose DNA is written into virtually every library, private and public, that has appeared in this country in the last nearly 300 years. And it's a great privilege for me to introduce a man who is its director, whom I've known for a very long time, who's had a distinguished career after receiving his PhD from Penn in English literature. He has worked at and been a leading administrator and visionary leader at the Rosenbach Library, the Pew Foundation, and the Free Library of Philadelphia. Join me in welcoming Michael Barsanti.
Peter has been a teacher and mentor and friend of mine for many years, and I'm grateful for that introduction. I would imagine at some point over the last few years you've had the opportunity to hear one of Peter's presentations. I remember going to one of Peter's presentations that was about American modernism and the visual arts, and the envy I felt at his ability to take a complicated topic and to tell an incredibly compelling narrative, accessible narrative out of it, is something I've always aspired to. Peter's combination of scholarly depth and but the ability to communicate clearly a sophisticated idea is something I've always admired. And of course, he just did that and preempted about half of what I'm going to say. So, thanks. I'm grateful to Peter for inviting me here today, and I'm grateful to you for coming on such a bitterly cold, difficult Ash Wednesday. Thank you. Maybe this is your first act of penance for Ash Wednesday, your first self-mortification. Before I start to talk about the Library Company, I wanted to, you know, there's been so much in the press, so much in the history community about all of the recent gyrations and configurations, particularly relating to the Philadelphia History Museum, its collection. And it has, one of the benefits of what is otherwise an awful situation has been that it's brought into the front of public consciousness and media the crisis, I'll call it that, the crisis among Philadelphia's history institutions. The talk I want to give today, as it pertains to the Library Company, is about how in my 2 years there, and over as we think about our strategy moving forward, we've gone back to our origins. We've gone back to Franklin's Junto as a model for what the Library Company should be. But I also think that in thinking about the broader problem in front of Philadelphia's history community and opportunity in front of it, that the Junto also provides a useful framework for thinking about a way forward with that. I think that Drexel University's stated intention and plan to take over the Philadelphia History Museum's collection and to oversee a new model for sharing it with the city in different ways is a bold plan. I'm grateful for them for doing that. I don't know what conversation we would be having if Drexel hadn't stepped forward with this idea. There are profound risks associated with what they're doing, and I think continued transparency and a continued conversation about how that collection will be administered is very important. I trust Roz Reamer and Paige Talbot deeply to execute on that idea. And we want to be a participant. I'm grateful for the conversation this has engendered around Philadelphia's need for a history museum or for some kind of history center of sorts. And I'm eager for the Library Company to be a participant in those conversations. Our strategic planning exercise we just completed was done by a company called TDC. They're based out of Boston. They're a fancy arts consulting company that has done a lot of work in the history sector nationally and in Philadelphia specifically. And I'm sure this is something you already know, but this is a slide they sent me early on in the planning process. You know, they said, "You know about Philadelphia's history community, right?" And what this chart, it's hard to see here, but this is a comparison of unrestricted net assets between history organizations in Boston versus Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, less than half, and this is a couple of years, this is 2012 information, less than half of Philadelphia's history organizations have 9 months or more of unrestricted net assets. Think of it basically as cash on hand, compared to Boston's 69%. What you have in Philadelphia is a large and dispersed group of history organizations that represent together what is perhaps the city's greatest asset. And where one of the shortcomings, one of the strange deficiencies in this community is that there is not really a central association or group that connects those organizations together. And I think some of the momentum that the issues with the History Museum and Drexel's subsequent move into that space will engender will be to connect the history organizations greater together. There is, I think, a really important conjunction of events, a sort of arrangement of planets here that's coming into alignment, that's coming into view between Philadelphia's history community, the funding community, the public sphere, and the conversation going on in the media about history. And it's all happening with the nation's 250th birthday, 7 years out in the distance, 2026. And so I think there is actually a really, I'm not going to modify the word unique, I think there is a unique set of situation, of circumstances here that make it possible to imagine for the first time that we might have a successful collective, association of history organizations, both to respond to Drexel's actions and to participate in it and ensure that that collection is well used, but also to look forward to 2026 and beyond to help the history organizations work in a more cohesive way. Maybe I should also say, I have a little note here. I should say the Library Company, one of its many blessings is that we are financially stable. We are not looking to merge. We do not need to merge with anybody, but rather we take our own stability and our history to be something we can use to be a leader in this field, and something that I hope personally to be able to do by helping to convene history organizations at a time when there are many advantages to doing so, and it's a good time. So let me start talking about the Library Company's past. Peter has already given a quick introduction to it. This is the youngest portrait of Benjamin Franklin that we know to exist. You knew this was, Peter's like shaking his head, I knew he was going to show this slide. We think this portrait is from around 1738. It's in the collection of Harvard University. And I wanted to put it up here just to remind everyone that when Franklin had this idea of the Library Company, he was 26 years old. This is our, again, it's a lousy slide, but this is one of our great treasures at the Library Company, the Peter Cooper view of Philadelphia, the first oil painting of any American city dating from 1720. This is the Philadelphia that Ben Franklin saw when he arrived here in 1724. In 1731, Philadelphia was a city of about 12,000 people, maybe 13,000 people. And Franklin, at that time, had just returned. He came to Philadelphia, had a formative but ill-conceived trip to London. It lasted about a year and a half. It came back. When he came back to this small city of 13,000 people. He was a voracious reader, and he was an incredibly gregarious person, and there simply weren't enough books in his own possession or that he would have access to really fuel that intellectual fire or to compensate for the loss of the coffeehouse culture that he had grown used to in London. So he set up this group, again, terrible illustration, but work with me, called the Junto. The Junto started in 1727, and it was a group of 12 men, including Franklin, who met every Friday. At first, they met in a tavern at 3rd and Market Street, but then eventually they met in the house of one of their members. The Junto met for 40 years, and it was Franklin's biographer, LeMay, calls it his university. It was the place where he tested his ideas. It was the place where he had conversations, sang songs, told jokes. It was a group of people. It was part chamber of commerce, part book group, part mutual improvement society. And it came out of what I think is perhaps Franklin's deepest genius, which was his genius for organizing people. And his awareness that, as smart as he was, he needed people, he needed a community of people to exchange, to converse with, to improve his ideas. In some ways, this idea of, for me, I think one of the key observations or realizations I had about the Library Company, let me skip back to the Junto for a second, is that the Library Company didn't start as a library. It started as a learning community. It started as a group of people who got together every week to learn from each other, to improve their ideas, to improve themselves, to look into how they were living the best life. The library was an accessory to that mission. I think of the Library Company as being the first public library. It was not the earliest library. Harvard had a library before we did. Yale had a library before us. But it was the first library built on the interests of its members. It was the first library that was open to the general public in the sense, you had to buy a share to borrow a book, at least at first, but very early in its history, the Library Company made its books available even to people who weren't shareholders. But it was this idea of it was an accessory to a learning community, and this is what I mean when I think about moving forward. To me, the other analogy here is the cliche about a church being its congregation, not its building. In many ways, a library is its community as much as it's its collection. And for us moving forward, I think a sharper focus on that community, on that learning community, a community of scholars, but also a community of learners, beyond our scholarly community, is what is really going to drive the Library Company forward. This impossible to read slide, your eye exam is free here. These are the articles of association of the Library Company. So the first idea for the Library Company, as Franklin describes it, was that the members of the Junto, who all had a couple of books lying around at home, would take all of the books they owned individually and bring them together into one place. And then the members of the Junto could borrow books from each other without having to go to each other's houses. They would all be there. And Franklin suggests that they use the books to settle arguments during Junto meetings. Rousseau didn't say that. Rousseau said this. And so they could use the books to settle arguments, but also to borrow from them. This scheme didn't work for the familiar reason that people didn't return the books. So as soon as books didn't come back, then people would just pull their books out and say, no one's going to take my books. Sometimes they came back damaged, they didn't come back at all. So the members of the Junto all took their books home. And so Franklin had the idea of, what if we all put in some money, started a company, used the capital that we all put together to buy books for the benefit of all of us, and then anyone who bought in a share could borrow books, and then they would pay an annual fee so that we could buy more books. And the fee that he proposed was 40 shillings. People always say 40 shillings and not 2 pounds. I'm not sure why, but 40 shillings. And if they could get 50 members, then they, to pay 40 shillings, then they would have £200, which could buy them a nice starting collection of books. And so this was an idea that Franklin came up with in the spring of 1731. These articles were initially prepared in July of 1731. He spent the next 6 months chasing down people in Philadelphia to try to find his 50 people. All the members of the junto went out to try to find 50 people. I sometimes imagine you can sort of see the scene in a, you know, Philadelphia Trinity on some Sunday morning with a guy waking up, having come home late from the tavern and having to tell his wife, "Honey, I ran into Franklin last night and he's starting this library thing and I told him I'm going to give him 40 shillings for it. I just needed to tell you." He told him, "Franklin, what? No one knew what a library was, or that, you know, what this idea of a library was. The kids need shoes, Obadiah. You're giving 40 shillings to Franklin. Why?" It's important to note that the founding members of the library company were artisans. They weren't aristocrats. They weren't professionals. There was one attorney. But the founding 50 members were shoemakers, cabinet makers, other kinds of artisans. This is a receipt that you would get if you paid your 40 shillings. This was your buy-in to the library company. We estimate this amount of money is equivalent to about 2 weeks' pay, so it for an artisan of the time, so not an insubstantial amount. But for that, this is not long after the library company started. They made books available to people who were not shareholders, but you had to put a deposit down. And the deposit was in the form of a little promissory note. This is an example of that. This is a promissory note. I will promise to pay £5 if I don't return this book. So one of the ways you can look at this is that Franklin didn't start the first library, but Franklin did come up, was the first person to come up with the idea of the library fine. It was his idea that if you borrowed a book from the library company and you didn't return it, you had to pay a fine. And it's based on that premise that the library company still exists 290 years after it was founded. We don't circulate books anymore, but library fines were a pretty important strategy. The first books bought by the library company were very practical books. There wasn't a lot of religion. There wasn't a lot of literature, although I'm proud to say a copy of Paradise Lost was one of the first books bought by the library company. When the shareholders put together their £200, they put together a shopping list of books which they had prepared with James Logan, who had directed them on, oh, a library of your kind should have these books. But they also took suggestions from the group. This is a letter that reproduces the shopping list, which, of course, you can't read. What I'm fascinated by are there are two English grammars, and there are actually three English grammars in the entire list. And to me, a lot of these books are very practical books. They're geography books, they're chemistry books, they're agriculture books. They're how-to books. And so if you're living in a town of 13,000 people on the edge of the civilized world, and you want a library book, you want a library book that's going to tell you how to grow food for your family, or how to make copper, or how to home remedies, a medical dictionary. Medical history and popular medicine in particular has been a core subject of the library company since its founding, and our collections have supported that. So the library company was founded by tradesmen. It had a very practical focus in its early round of books. This is one of our treasures. It's always on display. It's basically a suggestion box from around 1760. If you can't read the lettering, it says, "Gentlemen are requested to deposit in the lion's mouth titles of such books as they may wish to have imported." The word imported is important because, of course, very few books were available that were domestically produced. The books that the library company wanted were the ones that were in London. The library company's agent in London was a man named Peter Collinson, who was also the Bartrams family's agent. And there are wonderful stories of crates coming back from London to Philadelphia that are filled with plants for Bartram and books for the library company. I like that image of the books and the crates. I think this also, when the library company made its decision to become a research library, this fact that its collection was based on the preferences of its members and not on the preferences of a faculty, not to drive a certain pedagogical agenda or religious agenda, but rather were made because this is what the people of Philadelphia were interested in. That gives the core of the Library Company's collection incredible value to scholars. Because if you want to know what the people of Philadelphia were reading and thinking about in 1750 or 1760 or 1790, the collection of the Library Company can be said to reflect that because it's built around the interest of its members. Franklin was very proud of the Library Company. It's the one institution he was involved in that he mentions most in his autobiography. I'm interested in this particular quote from the autobiography because in it, Franklin talks about the connection of learning, the library company and the subscription library model, of which the Athenaeum is, you know, one of the most famous examples of, but talks about this model as being part of what made the United States intellectually ready for to be independent from England or from Britain. These libraries, it's right before this that he calls the Library Company the mother of all subscription libraries in North America. And for him, again, Franklin is proud of the model. He is proud that the Library Company became a model that was instantly replicated throughout the colonies in Boston, in Charleston, New York, that this model, and that the libraries have improved the general conversation of the Americans and made the common tradesmen and farmers as intelligent as most gentlemen from other countries, and perhaps have contributed in some degree to the stand so generally made throughout the colonies in defense of their privileges. I think here, too, there's a clue to the Library Company's future and the future of libraries generally. And a number of scholars have made this point that for the founding fathers, that they knew that the idea of a representative democracy, such as they were creating here in the United States, was a risky proposition. There had not been a successful one in the history of the world. And what they realized was that education was the key factor that would make their republican democracy successful. That you needed to have an educated population in order to make sure that the traditional weaknesses of republican democracy, its vulnerability to tyrants, its vulnerability to demagogues, that was going to be your insurance policy to make sure that the democracy would survive. And I think that's something that we have lost in our sense of what education is for. We're so often used to talking about the value of education in terms of its return on investment, in terms of your ability to get a good earning job. But for Jefferson in particular and for the other founding fathers, and you see a trace of it here in Franklin, education was necessary to make democracy work. It didn't work without it. And here I think this is Franklin thinking about the library as an educational institution for people who weren't in a school. My little slide for the mother of all subscription libraries, important here at the Athenaeum. The library, I put this slide in here also to remind me that the Library Company was also the first Library of Congress, one of its first locations. In the first 30 years of the Library Company, it was itinerant, peripatetic. It was in coffee shops. The books were located in coffee shops and in Robert Grace's house and different places. And it had hours that were changed. It was open on Saturdays usually and Wednesday evenings. But its first home was on the second upstairs in the Carpenter's Hall. And so when the First Continental Congress met in Carpenter's Hall, the Library Company was right above it. And all the members of the Continental Congress got circulation privileges at the library. And this was also true when the Continental Congress met at what is now Independence Hall. And it was considered an important asset that they could, there's a letter from one of the members of the Second Continental Congress to a friend outside of Philadelphia saying that he had just spoken to the librarian of the Library Company and asked him what the delegates were reading. And the librarian said, oh, you know, Montesquieu, Locke, the usual stuff, Hume, the usual stuff, what you'd expect. So it provided that sort of intellectual grounding and intellectual information for the members of the Continental Congress. It was also the library that served the constitutional conventions and the early federal government here in Philadelphia. This is an image from William Birch of the Library Company in its first dedicated home on Fifth Street. If this building looks familiar, that is because the American Philosophical Society recreated this facade in the 1950s, I believe. If you look on Fifth Street, I mean, I'm sure many of you are familiar with APS. This is a library crowd. What you see on Library Hall facing Fifth Street is a recreation of Library Company's building. And this is still what we think of when we think of like the original Library Company, even though it's 60 years after the company was founded. This is a painting that we have on display now in our reading room. It's a painting we're very proud of, but it's also very problematic. It's a painting by an artist named Charles Jennings. It dates from 1792. It was commissioned to hang in this building. It's called Liberty Presenting the Arts and Sciences. Charles Jennings was an American painter trained in London, living in London, and he was commissioned by the Library Company to do a painting for the new building. And when Jennings wrote to the board of the Library Company, he said, I'm paraphrasing, I'm thinking you want maybe an Athena or a Clio, the Muse of History, presenting knowledge to the new nation. And the board of the Library Company wrote back and said, no. Close, but no. We want it to be Liberty. And you can see Liberty's Liberty cap here, her traditional assignment. And we want it to be a group of freed slaves. And we want Liberty to be presenting the arts and sciences of knowledge to this group of freed slaves. And you can't really see it here, but these are broken chains at her feet. And these are celebrating freed slaves back here. The books in front of her are, I believe, architecture, chemistry, and on top, the catalog of the Library Company, which she is handing to them. This painting now hangs in our reading room. We're very proud of it because it helps to show that the Library Company had, even in its very early days, a lot of Quaker abolitionists who thought that the purpose of knowledge was to free people, and that the work the Library Company was doing would in some ways lead to the freedom of slaves. This is a controversial painting when it's hanging across the street from the Capitol, where you have slavery being debated at that very moment. Of course, slavery had been gradually put on a phase out in Pennsylvania from the 1780s, but is still a very hot topic in Independence Hall across the street. I think this is an interesting sign for that. But we also now are finding when we talk to our readers and our constituents about this painting that they see something problematic in it. When you know its origins, when you know the message it's trying to send, you understand it. But it is also sends a lot of messages that are unintended, but that are nevertheless present in this day and age. You have this virginal white, couldn't possibly be more white, figure of liberty presenting knowledge to the worthy African-American, supplicate African-Americans below. And this, for an organization that prides itself on its African-American historical collection, is kind of problematic. It's part of a conversation that we'll be having at the Library Company over the coming years about what is our real history in relation to slavery? What is our history, a kind of soul searching that many institutions, particularly colleges and universities, are doing. I think for us, the Library Company has always understood itself to have been on the right side of history in its support of abolitionists. But of course, Franklin was a slave owner, James Logan was a slave owner. Many of the founding members of the Library Company owned slaves, and it had a relationship to the slave economy. This is an ongoing question, but an important part of our history. From the early days of the Library Company, it was also a kind of cabinet of curiosities. It was the first collecting institution, arguably the first museum in Philadelphia. And so people would come back from their travels with all kinds of weird stuff, but like fossils that now are in the Academy of Natural Sciences. This is the hand of a mummy that Benjamin West gave to the Library Company in the 1790s when Egyptian artifacts were fairly easy to get your hands on in London. The box has this inscription, this was a gift presented by Benjamin West. There are many kinds of curiosities like this. Most of them were either traded to institutions that where they were better used, like the Penn Museum or the Academy of Natural Sciences. There's a story about the Library Company having a mastodon thigh bone that was traded to Charles Peel for his reconstruction of a full mastodon. But I think the point is that the members of the Library Company, again, this learning community, brought things there that they wanted to share with other people. This would eventually come to include early photography, maps, scientific equipment, telescopes, all sorts of things, One of the new trends in public libraries is lending out things like musical instruments and telescopes. The library company was doing it in the 18th century. The library company benefited from absorbing a number of other libraries that did not succeed as lending libraries or as association libraries, but it absorbed the library of James Logan, who I've mentioned now several times. This is one of a copy of Euclid's Geometry that was in Arabic, and what you see, Logan taught himself Arabic, and taught himself Hebrew, taught himself, any, he was a polymath, a genius, and so you see here his work in translating back and forth the Euclid. And I wanted to put this up here to make the point that the library company's collection, in many ways, it's when people ask me, what is the library company's collection? And it's very hard to put your hands around it. It's almost all printed material. Let's start there. But print means books and pamphlets, but it also means photographs. And it also means lithographs and copper plates, images, many, a wonderful library of images. But we focus on printed material because we think that we are focused on what was circulating in the intellectual community of Philadelphia. What were the, and it's not just American books. This is an example of a book printed in Rome in the 16th century. It's not just American books. It's what books were being used and read and collected in America. Remember that suggestion box, books that are imported. The American Antiquarian Society in Worcester collects things printed in America. We're interested in things printed in America, but our focus is what was available in America. What was, and where that takes us into books that were printed in London and Paris and around the world, yes, that is still, what books, what printed material was part of our universe? That also includes ephemera. We have a wonderful collection of ephemera. Really, what is the printed material that helps to tell the story of daily life, daily intellectual life in Philadelphia? No story of the library company would be complete without James and Phoebe Rush. In the 18-midnight, James Rush on the right was one of the sons of Benjamin Rush. His wife Phoebe was from the Ridgway family. When they died, their estate left over $1 million in $1,850 to the library company, but with a condition that the library company use some of that money to build a new fireproof building outside the center of the city. The will's executor was a real estate developer, and he found a wonderful spot for the new library company building. And he built it before the library company had even accepted the gift. And it was basically handed to the library company as a take it or leave it situation. He built the new library company building in South Philadelphia at Broad and Christian Streets, near an area where he was hoping to develop houses for real estate. And this was in the 1850s, early 1860s. I'm embarrassed to say I did not know until just before I started the library company that the Performing Arts High School on South Broad Street was the library company, was the Ridgway branch of the library company. It was eventually used by the Free Library as a branch for a number of years in the 1940s. It was eventually sold to the city. It lay abandoned for probably 50 years until it became the Performing Arts High School in the 1990s. That's probably a good segue to the present. The library company was Philadelphia's main public library from its founding in 1730 up until the mid-19th century. The Free Library of Philadelphia was founded in the 1890s. I used to work at the Free Library, and people would sometimes ask me, why is it called the Free Library? I mean, aren't all public libraries free? What's with the free? And it's called the Free Library because its main competitor in the space was the library company, which was not free, except, you know, free to borrow, not free to borrow. And so it was called the Free Library because the existing library in that space was a library company. But if you went up to someone on the streets of Philadelphia in 1840 or 1870 and asked them, where's the library at? They would tell you not to end your sentence with a preposition, and they would direct you to the library company because that was the Philadelphia Library. It took the library company about 60 years to realize that its business model had been undermined by someone giving away for free what they were charging for. By the time you get to after World War II in the 1950s, the library company was on hard times, and it was being managed and operated by the Free Library, and the Ridgway branch was a Free Library branch. I should say, in addition to the South Philadelphia Ridgway branch, the main branch was across the street from where, basically across the street from where the library company is now, in a Frank Furness building that has since been torn down. But that was where most of the library, that's where the 19th century, that's where most of the books and people and work of the library company was done, was in that downtown location. The South Philly location was never successful for the library company. It was eventually really just a storage space. In the 1950s, Edwin Wolfe II, I'm the Edwin Wolfe II director of the library company. Edwin Wolfe, who was sort of a refugee from the Rosenbach, Edwin Wolfe was one of Dr. Abraham Simon Rosenbach's proteges. And when Dr. Rosenbach died, Philip Rosenbach, who survived him, and Philip's associates really did not have much time for Edwin. And Edwin had built an expertise from his work with the Rosenbach Company and the work with the early Rosenbach Foundation. The Rosenbach Museum was really Edwin Wolfe's idea. And Edwin had built up this enormous knowledge of early American printing and early American prints. And the Rosenbachs didn't want it. Philip Rosenbach didn't want it. So Edwin went to the library company, where he looked at that collection and saw in it the extraordinary treasure that was there. And it was really Edwin's idea. The modern library company is the creation of Edwin Wolfe, who realized that the collection of library company was a research collection. And so it was his idea to his sort of comeback plan for the library company was to stop circulating books, sell off the modern books, the 20th century books, focus on the scholarly depth of the collection, which was it was and is unique in that it is this surviving 18th century collection of library. You know, the library company is not just a collection of historical materials. It is the historical artifact itself. It has survived from 1731 on. And it was Edwin Wolfe who saw that and who thought that if you could focus on the life of the library company as a research library, this would be its path forward. And it was John Van Horn who succeeded Edwin and James Green, the current librarian, who followed on that and really realized that idea. Edwin built this building, 1964 building, attached, no accident here, sited right next to the Historical Society. We are attached to the Historical Society. Our collections are built, are completely complementary to the library company, to the Historical Society. They have the manuscripts, we have the books. There's a door between them. There's still one door, there used to be two, now there's one door between them. One of the things at stake as we look at the leadership transition at HSP is for us, HSP's manuscripts and their collections, they also hold our manuscripts, we hold their books. It's a really, for scholars, it's very important that those two collections be together because they're together they have greater research power than they do separately. So today, we are still in the library company of Edwin Wolfe and John Van Horn and Jim Green. Our primary program, our primary work is serving scholars. That's what we do best. And that's what, you know, we give out about 60 fellowships a year. That's our largest program. And it's something that most people in Philadelphia don't really know about. If you were a historian of 18th century America in California or in France, you know the library company and you love the library company. Our scholars know us and love us because our whole strategy for the last 60 years has been based on cultivating them, serving them, and doing a great job of it. When we talk to our constituents, when we talk to our scholars, they say, the library company is my favorite place because your staff knows more than anyone else's staff because they serve us incredibly well. And they're just really helpful. You know, I've heard this story many times. I went to the library company thinking I was going to look at X, Y, and Z. Jim Green told me about A, B, and C, and it completely changed my work. That's what we do really well. What we haven't done well is connect that knowledge, all of that work, all of those scholars to our broader public. And that's my job. That's what we're doing now. And it's important for us, but it's also important for the scholars. So here's what's happening to our core constituency. If our core constituency is scholars, this is what's happening to scholars. The chart you're looking at shows two numbers. One is the number of history PhDs that are being awarded in American universities. The blue line shows the number of jobs that are available for those history PhDs. And this is a chart that comes from the American Historical Association. This chart goes up to 2017. They just published their 2018 version of this chart. It gets worse. That blue line goes farther down. So what do we do? What does a library company do well? We serve scholars really well. Well, what happens when your scholar's world is changing dramatically? And in a way, it's not entirely responsible to just be preparing people to finish their dissertations. Now, I will say that the people who tend to make their way to get library company fellowships, who are working on dissertations or junior faculty, are kind of at the top of the food chain among the history in the scholarly world. They're the ones who are most likely to get these dwindling number of jobs, and they're still very much focused on it. But I think that what my realization has been is that if we are to really to serve history, humanities scholars in the humanities community, we need to find other ways for that knowledge to reach the general public. Oh, and also, the general public really needs that information. We've become divorced from our history, we've become separated from our history. There's fantastic history going on, but it's locked up within the sort of academic universe. And the library company, not being an academic institution, I don't report to a provost, I don't have a university board. I love provosts, Peter, it's not that. But I don't have to convince a university of my value. I have to convince a community of my value. And we have this wonderful asset in the form of our scholars. What if we can find ways for them to reach the general public beyond what they're doing? Here's the other problem we have against this. This is a study that was produced by the Southern Poverty Law Center a couple of years ago. It includes the fact that only 8% of high school students identified slavery as the primary cause of the Civil War. When I think about what problems out in the world does a library company need to address, this is one of them. And to me, this speaks to this enormous gap between the fantastic history that's being done, especially the history of slavery, African-American history, which is a huge strong point for the library company, and it's just not getting into schools. Now, we're not configured to serve schools directly. We're not going to have an education program. We're not going to be able to serve busloads of children. That's not us. But we can teach the teachers, and we can help the scholars who are producing this work figure out how they can reach the teachers. For us, it's really focusing on those scholars is the key part of the strategy. I'm going over my time. I said I was going to do this, Peter. I'm going to try to wrap it up soon. I want to talk a little bit about libraries, because I think where libraries are going, as in general, provides signposts for us, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I would just point out in this chart, where's my pointer? This number in the middle this is from a recent Pew study that shows people really thinking about libraries as places, yes, mostly to borrow print books. But this is interesting to me, this number right in the middle, 27% to attend classes, programs, and lectures. Look at that increase is significant. This is a trend, I think, I'm really grateful for the time I spent with the Free Library Foundation, because it gave me a window into the amazing public library universe, which I love. But there's an analogy often talked about in library land, as Siobhan Reardon calls it, of libraries moving from a supermarket model to a kitchen model. That it used to be that if you, say, wanted to learn about beekeeping, you would go to the library, you would find a book on beekeeping, you'd take it off the shelf and bring it home. Well, that model, Google has sort of gotten rid of that for us, right? That model of you go to the library to get your book and bring it home, people still do that. It's great. It's still, like, those numbers are actually surprisingly resilient and flat in terms of book circulation. But what libraries are really becoming more is a place where you go to learn beekeeping. This sort of, you learn, instead of getting your food off the super, there are too many metaphors being mixed here, but instead of getting your product off the shelf, you go there to learn it. So now you might go to the library to learn beekeeping from a beekeeper. You might go there to meet a beekeeper. But the role of actually getting the book off the shelf, that is where libraries lose to Google. Where libraries don't lose to Google is in being homes for learning communities. Again, the church is the congregation, not the building. This chart just shows that library usage is not dropping compared to what popular wisdom thinks. It's actually increasing. And this is, again, from the Pew study showing that what should libraries offer? Well, they should be offering more digital programs. Again, this is public libraries we're talking about, not research libraries like the Library Company or subscription libraries like the Athenaeum, but I think that these are all part of the same ecosystem, all part of the same universe that's looking to, and all part of this answer to the question that anyone involved with the library gets several times a day, like, do we need libraries when there's Google? Yes, is of course my answer. But it's yes for a different reason. I have to show you charts. This chart, I just wanted to show you, this is a chart from the National Center for Education Statistics, and it's a chart of people participating in humanities, like adult education classes over the course of, this is about 10 years old, but it's a useful survey. It shows the difference between 2001 and 2005. I'm just interested in this group, 55 to 64, 25 to 34. These folks, between 35 and 54, they're raising kids. We don't see much of them. But 55 to 64, right, so these are, there is a significant uptick in people participating in programming, looking to libraries for that programming, wanting learning communities from their libraries. And that's where I think a place like the Library Company, going back to the Junto, this is what the Junto was, that the Junto was really trying to recreate that experience for people is where the future of the Library Company lies. The seal of the Library Company, which I love, designed by Franklin, awkward Latin phrase around it that basically, communiter bona profundere deum est, to pour forth benefits for the common good is divine. This was Franklin's idea, the sort of fountain of knowledge pouring into little receptacles, but I think it again speaks to this idea of the Library Company as the first public library, not advancing the cause of God. It's a little Franklinian equivocation here. It's divine, right? It is godlike to serve your community, but not serve God, right? Directly, that's maybe implied. This is our old mission statement, perfectly good mission statement, but one that I would say that's typical of a collecting organization. Look at these, this preserving, interpreting, making available, and augmenting the valuable materials in our care. Stewardship, the typical museum, old-fashioned museum mission statement basically says, our job is to take care of and share with the public our unique collection. Interesting that the first phrase is to foster scholarship. When people ask me why no one has ever heard of a Library Company, you know, I might say it's probably because you're not an 18th century historian. It's not an accident. This was a strategy, and it worked. But it's time to move, it's time to build off of it. Not reject it, but use it and move it forward. Our new mission statement says, doesn't say to foster scholarship, it says to foster a learning community. This was a big change that my board and staff did not really seem to push back on. But I think because it's so resonant, it is resonant to this idea of Library Company starting from a learning community. I'm not gonna sell you my whole strategic plan because I've sort of pitched it to you and I'm going on too long. But I really see this period in the Library Company's life as being one where we go to build that community, which is also building a donor base at the same time, same people. Improving access to the collection, not by engaging in massive new digitization projects, but by looking at our cataloging, looking at the ways in which doing, you know, I think Peter and the Athenaeum got a lot of really wonderful press for their for the work that they're doing and the affiliation they have with the University of Pennsylvania and using their systems, their cataloging and circulation systems. We're also talking to Penn. And also serving scholars, both keeping that as our basic focus, we serve scholars by helping them write their books, but also helping them to innovate. Learning community. This is my illustration of this idea that the Library Company, through its fellows and through its staff, has an enormous reserve of historical knowledge. There's an enormous supply of this. But it doesn't reach the public now because it only goes through the academic systems of university presses and refereed journals and so forth. There is also, we have supply, and we know that there's demand. There's an enormous public appetite, and so our job is to connect those two. And I would be remiss if I didn't pitch our new podcast, which again is designed to take the work of our scholars and bring it to the public. But this is another step of part of bringing the work of our scholars to our community to show, like, look at the fantastic work these people are doing. It's now 5 minutes of four. I've gone on even longer than I told Peter I was going to, but I would love to entertain any questions you might have. Yeah.